It was right on the first floor, between the landing, and it was laying there. It was clearly a stuffed lion's head. In, I'd say, an advanced stage of decay. I don't remember a smell specific to it, but I do remember it had at least a few teeth. Its eyes looked very glazed, obviously, which is an effect that I think you get when you stuff an animal. The skin was intact, still had its ears. I'm not a specialist about stuffing animals, so I couldn't tell you when it was done. So it doesn't have the mane, so it's a lioness. And I think quite typical of what you'd find as hunting trophies for a lot of people of that generation that came to Kenya or to Africa to hunt. They would hunt and then stuff these animals and have them up on display. But yeah, quite a bit of an odd thing to come across.
It's moved since. So it's moved several times. In fact, the first time I saw it, it wasn't at the top of the stairs. It was sitting on a desk. And it was a lot bigger. It was much bigger. Right now it's just the head, but most of the skin was still there. So it was like a rug.
It's part of those things that you find at the library, very much like the elephant tusks that are downstairs that belong to a completely different time, but that feel like a kind of sanitizing if you attempt to remove them. They do form a huge part, I think, of the history of that building. It's just a kind of fascinating thing to come across, you know, a stuffed lion's head.
Yeah, but I mean, that these guys preserved it, like, look at this. It's had 90 years and it's still, over 90 years. And
it's over 90 years.
It's still going.
It's over 90 years. So this lioness, mm-hmm. How did she get here?
Good question. I don't think she kind of just got up one day and decided to walk over to the library and just lay there.
No. No, that's very unlikely. So, let's talk about hunting. Surveillance, trackers, people following footprints.
Okay, now.
Not of people, but of this animal. They are stalking it. This quest for that one animal has been going on for days and days and will not be over until they shoot it.
And I'm guessing you don't mean with a camera, do you?
Oh, God, no.
Oh, no.
No, no, no. We don't mean with a camera. It will not be over until they shoot this animal dead with a gun. So it's a heart-pumping primal quest that's definitely for their leisure, and it's something that's known as the chase.
Ah, the chase. That sport. Can we even call it a sport?
Well, it does come with its own trophies.
Mm.
You've got tusks, horns, and lion heads. But the adrenaline, the tracing, the subduing, the dominating, and the killing, that is what those guys were here for.
And the thrill out there in the so-called wild.
Mm-hmm. And the high, that high that is at the heart of the industry of safari hunting. It's an industry that in many ways epitomizes the story of how human life and wildlife have been pitted against each other over the past 100 years in Kenya. Once harmonious relationship turned completely fraught.
Turned fraught because people and wildlife are forced to wrestle for space, for land, for the right to roam, and the right to life.
Mm-hmm. And so how did this happen? Perhaps there's no better place to start than with these trophies in this library. Lying here as remnants from a hunting trip of Sir Northrop Macmillan, who came to Kenya in 1904. Avid listeners of the podcast will remember that in episode 1, we mentioned that Macmillan, whom the Macmillan Memorial Library is named after, came to Kenya for a safari and stayed most likely for the squandering potential. Joke.
Do you though?
No. No, I don't. Not really.
I didn't think so.
He came to hunt and stayed to pillage. I mean, build. A life here in Kenya. What he got very good at and spent a lot of time doing was running expeditions into the wild as an industry was being formed. The industry of tourism, safari hunting tourism. Nowadays, people would say those things are separate from each other.
What, hunting and safaris?
Yes, but not when you look at how this industry came about and these souvenirs from his trips or trips that other men took, these so-called trophies that sit in the library are where we will start our look into the history of race and animals in Kenya. This is the podcast, A Palace for the People, where we excavate the library and find from within it pieces that unlock Kenyan history and help us understand our present. I am Angela Washuka.
And I am Wanjiru Koinange.
To understand Kenya's history with the wild world, let's go back to the late 1800s. Our ancestors coexisted with wild animals.
Well, they kind of had to. I mean, they were there. The animals were there.
Everyone was there. So yeah, they did. They coexisted. And different communities had different relationships to animals, but mostly they just existed.
Most African languages don't actually have a word for conservation because that was just how you lived. You kept the river clean because you want clean water. You didn't destroy the forest because you needed to get wood fuel. You needed to get medicinal plants. You needed to keep bees there. You needed to do various rituals and visit sacred sites in the forest. So you didn't destroy it. So conservation was just the way we lived.
This is Dr. Mordecai Ogada.
I'm a carnivore ecologist by training. But now I've gotten more into matters around conservation policy and community rights and responsibilities vis-a-vis conservation.
The concept of conserving Kenya spaces and animals from the people who had been living alongside them is a relatively new one. It came about after white settlers arrived.
So this idea of conserving, let me make sure I get it right. It's like setting aside special land that is just for the animals to not be disturbed by humans.
Correct.
With the idea that this will help them flourish, right?
Right. And before we get to what land and whose land, oh, and who is designating the land and how, please note that this concept came about during British rule of Kenya from people who, in their own societies, had done a remarkable job of decimating a lot of their wildlife.
In Britain, we have lost countless species over the centuries, and that's been primarily driven by habitat loss, but also persecution and hunting.
This is Richard Banting from Rewilding Britain, and he says we've got to change the way we think about places like Britain and wildlife. Historically, places like Britain have not always been nature poor and industrialized spaces. It took some serious human effort to destroy space for animals.
We've overexploited habitats and ecosystems, and we've overexploited and overhunted and overpersecuted the wildlife, to the point where now our ecosystems are shredded. There are holes all over our ecosystems where there should be different species, from smaller species, from like tree frogs, right through to larger species such as lynx and wolf.
Isn't that something? I sometimes forget that Britain had all this wildlife too before it started exporting its version of conservation.
Yes, it seems kind of unfathomable to think of wolves in Britain, but why? Why, when we have lions in Kenya, why wouldn't there be apex predators that British people would need to learn to live with too? Like wolves.
Right.
Wolves.
So, instead of learning to live with wolves, they hunted them to extinction in the mid-1700s.
And actually, I'm remembering now all the childhood fables and nursery rhymes that are so anti-wolf.
Exactly. What's the time, Mr. Wolf? 1 o'clock, the dinner time. And the wolf, it's all the children.
All the children. The little Red Riding Hood and the big bad wolf just here huffing and puffing with three little piggies. And they blow down the house and everything. There's so many narratives. I can see the campaign now. Woo, yeah, the poor wolves.
Yeah. So these animals had already gone extinct in Britain when colonists came to shoot animals in Kenya in the late 1800s and early 1900s. So they thought, aha, we better save these animals.
Initially, game reserves were meant to preserve wildlife for hunting.
This is Professor Ruben Madeka, an associate professor of history at Egerton University in Joro. He says from the first game reserve, which was proclaimed back in 1897, colonization began to disrupt how Africans lived side by side with animals. Killing an animal for food or any other reason now required a license and an approved weapon, like a gun. So apparently in the beginning, anyone who hunted without a license was considered a poacher.
Africans were mainly considered as poachers because they didn't have the capacity to pay for hunting licenses. Besides, they considered wild animals in their areas as part of their inheritance, part of their resources.
Right. I mean, Africans had always killed, eaten, and sustained a relationship with wildlife. And so, of course, they resisted the new laws brought in by the British that tried to intervene in their way of life, particularly hunter-gatherer communities. But the British putting up fences around the very land that they had previously roamed and lived on.
Madness.
But you know our people, they have always found a way to get around the colonists. Or we all wouldn't be here today. But with that said, certain species were definitely off limits.
For a long time, most of the colonial administrators allowed those who were considered as hunter-gatherer groups to continue hunting so long as they didn't hunt certain animals like elephants or rhino. But whenever they tried now to hunt elephants, they could be dealt with because now it was felt like they were doing so for profit.
Okay, so here I feel it always bears remembering that before the British government ruled Kenya, the folks in charge were the British Imperial East Africa Company, a limited liability company with shareholders and everything, trading in London, and they ran the region for profit.
Yep. And so the spoils of hunting, the bounty, if you want to call it that, the kitty, the prize money, the winnings, the tusks, the horns, the lion's heads, the profits, that was a huge part of the appeal of the budding industry that the settlers wanted for themselves.
In the early colonial days, some animals were considered farming, especially animals that destroyed crops. Lions, the cats generally, were also considered farming.
Vermin? Did he say vermin?
He did. Vermin, as in pests. As in bring the doom, we spray and kill it, chop chop. And so it should surprise nobody how wantonly animals were killed back then.
Later on, from the 1920s, all animals and birds became game. Only animals like monkeys that could destroy crops and didn't seem to have any economic value were not so highly regarded. So game animals were given, say, maximum protection, while vermin were available for destruction.
Because of the sheer number of animals that fell into the vermin category and Kenya's reputation as a hunter's paradise, more and more hunters came to try their luck. It's not known how many elephants, cheetahs, lions, or buffalo were killed in the early 20th century. One memoir written by a Scottish hunter called W.M.D. Bell boasts of killing over 1,000 elephants.
Ah.
Yeah. In a period of 16 years.
Oh my goodness.
We're talking about between 1902 and 1918.
Ugh, imagine.
But what we do know is that the hunting industry, farming itself, and the dispossession of people from the land they had managed for centuries, all of this meant that by the 1950s, wildlife in Kenya was much, much more depleted than it had been before the Brits arrived.
And it sounds like by the 1960s, Kenya's wildlife was in major trouble.
Oh yeah. But so was Britain's rule.
Can you imagine in Kenya, a place you've lived in for a long time, the day when Africans will govern the country and you will be governed by them?
Well, I haven't really given it an awful lot of thought.
That day came. Kenya gained independence. And Europeans in Kenya, with large pieces of land that had been hunting havens, began to think about what to do next.
George Adamson, grand old man of Africa, hunter turned conservationist, whose name will always be linked with the lioness Elsa and the film Born Free.
Conservation.
Yep, a neat little way to ensure your insane-sized property is allegedly doing a public good while also justifying keeping people off of it.
In 1978, the president put in a total ban on hunting because wildlife numbers were crashing and they could no longer sustain the hunting and the insatiable appetite for trophies, you know, be they elephant trophies or rhino horn or whatever it is.
This is Jack Marubu from the Nature Conservancy.
So there was a total ban from 1978, but because there was already an appetite, an existing appetite for wildlife products, it went on unabated and the poaching crisis picked up. So from then, the wildlife management department was established to kind of put a hold on the poaching. It was funded by the World Bank, and the game department came into being. And this is where the paramilitary and militarization of wildlife resources started.
Poaching is a problem. Rangers on the ground have been directed to another dead elephant.
Now, the 30 elephants have already been killed. Nairobi National Park held peaceful protests over the weekend, opposing the alleged fencing.
According to the residents, KWS rangers have been patrolling the area with heavy machinery.
The law will ensure people living in the parks and conservancies are relocated far from wild animals, to reduce conflicts, as well as give tourists ample time.
In the 1970s and 80s, you didn't really hear about hunting anymore. The word we all heard was poaching. And in order to stop the poaching, the KWS and private reserves, called conservancies, began to train elite rangers. They wore khaki uniforms and carried firearms and defended certain spaces and fortified them. It was called fortress conservation.
The first sign of violence is a fence suddenly coming up across this landscape that you knew all your life, or from your grandfather's stories, they used to talk about how they'd walk to wherever, and suddenly there's a fence and you can't go there. And then suddenly there's people in uniform with guns driving around, land cruisers or aircraft flying above you.
The violence of a fence is akin to the violence of our national boundaries that were forcefully erected by the British, severing communities in half or restricting access to resources. It obviously wasn't very popular with many of the people who actually dealt with the rangers day to day.
Wildlife conservation cannot be a war. Right now we are in this box where we cannot practice wildlife conservation without guns, bullets, fences, all the types of violence you can think about. It's not supposed to be a violent pursuit, but in Africa it invariably is. In Kenya, it invariably is.
Fortress conservation, gosh, mm-hmm. What a mess. Guns and fences don't sound like good solutions at all.
Well, luckily, a lot of people in the conservation world agree with you. And there's a new preferred way of doing things today called community-based conservation.
Community-based. Okay, I like the sound of this already.
And this is when a community in a wildlife-rich area manages the wildlife that's spilling into their land.
Wait a minute, hang on. So you're saying that we go through all this history and all this violence over decades and decades just end up back where we started?
Mm-hmm.
Like in a circle?
Yep.
With a community managing its relationship to wildlife like it did over 100 years ago?
Yes and no. Okay, so on the one hand, after years of being locked out, indigenous communities are able to live side by side with wildlife and their livestock. They have more of a say over what happens on their land. But on the other hand, history has happened.
History has happened.
The state is now the ultimate decider of the biggest decisions, like what animal counts as food, if hunting is allowed.
And Kenya is one of those countries in Africa with a zero hunting policy, right?
Zero. Namibia, Zimbabwe, South Africa, people can still trophy hunt over there. But Kenya has put its foot down and said no to ivory, no to hunting, just no. So, here we are, a nation at work to get back that lost relationship that we once had with nature, the land, and animals. The old paradigm of protecting nature from people without realizing that it was those very people who protected nature previously has to shift. Because it didn't used to be like this, but somewhere along the line, wildlife turned into a thing for other people that could only be experienced with khaki shorts, a safari hat, the biggest Land Cruiser, and something to shoot the animal with, whether it be a camera or a gun. This is A Palace for the People. I am Angela Washuka.
And I am Wanjiru Koinange. This episode was produced by me, Wanjiru Koinange, Angela Washuka, Mae Francis, and Ida Holly Nambi. This is a Fathom Sirens production. You can learn more about our work by visiting bookbank.org.
This podcast is supported by the Cultural Protection Fund, a partnership between the British Council and the UK Government's Department for Digital, Culture, Media and Sport. Special thanks to the National Geographic Society. Thank you for listening.